Welcome everyone to the CCL National Call. I'm Madeline Pera and I'm your host today since our executive director, Mark Reynolds, is on vacation. Let's all do like him and remember to savor what's here while we work to save it. During our meeting today, we'll get to learn about some wonderful work being done in the transportation sector. And as always, we'll share some highlights from our work and share the actions for the next month that we're encouraging you to take. I hope that you've also taken some time to savor the vote in the Senate a couple of weeks ago on the Growing Climate Solutions Act. Most of you are familiar with this legislation because you helped build support for it. We knew this bill would pass the Senate because, thanks to your advocacy and that from other friends, by the time of the vote, it had 27 Democrats, 26 Republicans, and one independent as co-sponsors, more than enough to ensure passage. And as you can see, the sponsorship was fully bipartisan with nearly equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans. So how did the actual vote turn out? It passed 92-8. 92-8, I just keep saying that, 92-8. 92% of the Senate voted yes on the Growing Climate Solutions Act. This bill was so bipartisan that even the opposition was bipartisan, with 5 senators on the left and 3 on the right voting no. So it moves on to the House next, sometime this year we anticipate. Please encourage your representatives to support it. Of course, you also continued to build up co-sponsorship of the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act in the House. Many of you held lobby meetings in the last month and more are scheduled this month. The number of co-sponsors grew in the last month from 70 to 77. So I'll share more news later. I'm really excited to hear from our speaker today. Allie Kelly is the executive director of the Ray Foundation. She's already known to our volunteers in Georgia, and that's how I came to learn about the work that she and her organization are doing there and elsewhere. It's a beautiful reminder that while we in CCL are doing the essential and difficult work of moving Congress to act on carbon pricing, there are other people tackling other important things that need to be done. Allie will describe her work far better than I could, so I'm going to turn this right over to you. Allie, welcome.
Thank you so much, Madeline, and thank you for featuring the Ray on your national call today. I'm so delighted and I'm really excited to be a part of this conversation with you today, partially because our work at the Ray is in near complete alignment with your work and your organization. We're on the same mission and we have the same goal, which is to accelerate the reduction of carbon emissions and to address climate change. And our work on the Ray focuses on the transportation sector. Why do we focus on the transportation sector? Because currently in the United States, transportation accounts for the largest share of carbon emissions. It's now about 29% of the nation's overall greenhouse gas emissions coming from transportation. And y'all know just as well as I do that this is a particularly vexing issue to confront because our transportation sector is full of individual choices. So we decide what kind of vehicle we drive. We decide what our commute patterns are. Businesses decide what their fleet vehicles look like and how they're managing those fleet vehicles. And with all of that individual choice and sector, there's a single silver bullet to address transportation carbon. We really have to have what we in the South would say is a buckshot approach, right? We have to have so many different avenues and pathways for drawing down carbon in the transportation sector. I want to tell you a little bit about our approach at the Ray, which is very technology and innovation driven. And I want to start with our story. So you may wonder, why are we called the Ray? The Ray is an 18-mile section of Interstate 85 in West Georgia. We are right up against the Georgia-Alabama state line in Troup County near the city of West Point, which has population 8,000, and the city of LaGrange, which is about population 38,000. So we are in an ex-urban, even rural section of the state of Georgia, about an hour and a half away from Atlanta. And this is where Ray Anderson grew up and where Ray Anderson grew his company Interface. And that is where we get our DNA in our work. Our motivation, our inspiration is from Ray Anderson and his surviving family. Y'all know the story of Ray. In 1994, he set public goals for his company Interface to go zero carbon, zero waste to landfill, and to use more renewable energy and more wastewater reuse. I'm pretty sure I was still worried about Aquanet hairspray and the ozone layer in 1994. It's amazing to me in 2021 that 30 years ago, Ray Anderson was already concerned about carbon and take action. And what he did during his work at Interface around his Mission Zero was that he documented the economics of his work. And what he was able to show and demonstrate was the business case for what became known as corporate sustainability and the circular economy. He documented nearly $450 million worth of savings and profit for his company, which was a $1 billion business. You're talking about nearly half the value of Interface Carpet Company wrapped up in their innovation and their mission to go zero waste and zero carbon. That's what drives our work at the Ray, because when Ray Anderson passed away in 2011, his youngest daughter, Harriet Anderson Langford, worked with the Georgia state government, our former governor Nathan Deal, to honor Ray and his legacy with a memorial highway on Interstate 85 on the stretch of interstate that connects his hometown in West Point to LaGrange, which is where Interface was founded. And you're now looking at an aerial view of what is commonly known as the Ray Highway. This is that Ray C. Anderson Memorial Highway stretch, as it has been reimagined and rebuilt into the nation's premier test bed for transportation technology that is focused on sustainability and human life safety. We have incorporated more than a dozen projects over the last 5 years, working in a chartered partnership with Georgia DOT and the Federal Highway Administration. I just want to say that again. We've been working with Georgia DOT and the Federal Highway Administration for 5 years, beginning, you know, in the Trump administration, on sustainability innovation and safety innovation on a working interstate. This stretch of interstate happens to host nearly 12 million drivers per year. And it is one of our open to the public, open to whatever may happen on the interstate, right? Somebody loses a, trying to move a sofa, and they lose it off the bed of their pickup truck, and it busts into, you know, 15 pieces. This is the real life trials and tribulations on the Eisenhower interstate system in the United States. And what we found is that our 18 miles in West Georgia is just like every mile in the rest of the country. And so we are leading the way with these technology demonstrations and projects, showing that you can have an interstate system that is safer, that is cleaner, and that is more productive. And you can see on the overview, our work is very broad. Everything from renewable energy to clean transportation, also innovating in how we manage the roadside plantings and the roadside soils, and also preparing the infrastructure for connected and autonomous vehicles. And our work isn't just focused in West Georgia, because like I said, we wanna show on this 18-mile corridor, this premier test bed, what folks in other states can do anywhere. So you can see that we're now in 2021, actively working in more than 13 states with more than 20 transportation agencies. The project work in these states varies quite a bit. We don't require that the entire ecosystem of the Ray Highway be adopted by another state or a transportation partner. We just want to go into other parts of the country to help solve problems and to help solve for transportation carbon. I'm going to show you just a few of our projects on the Ray Highway that we're working on in other states that I believe directly relate to our alignment and our shared mission around carbon reductions. Our very first project on the Ray Highway was an EV charging station. Ours happens to be supported by solar power. And this EV charging station is actually at a federal highways and state DOT rest area right at the Georgia-Alabama border. We actually updated the EV charging station during the COVID year. We tripled the amount of power available. We went from 50 kW to 175 kW. This is a great opportunity for rest areas, for truck parking lots, and for visitor centers across the country to be offering EV charging truck stop electrification and to be using solar power as an input, because that makes these services, the electrification of transportation and the decarbonization of transportation, needs to be resilient. And so solar power and backup battery systems can ensure that we have resilient electrification systems to help clean power transportation across the country. And we're not just stopping our work at wire charging. The RAE is also an innovation partner to the Aspire Center. If you haven't heard about the Aspire Center, please look them up online. They're located in Utah. They're supported by the National Sciences Foundation. They're one of the NSF Engineering Research Centers. And what they are is at the tip of the spear of wireless charging while you drive in a lane, which is what you're seeing on this slide. You're seeing loops, inductive loops embedded in the pavement, using a magnetic field to transfer AC energy to vehicles that are moving across that lane. This is a very safe way to charge the batteries of electric cars and electric trucks because it's a just-in-time power delivery system. You need to have the coils embedded or the loops embedded in the pavement, and you need to have a receiver on the underside of a vehicle. And we're particularly excited at the RAE about the possibilities for our Class 8 heavy-duty trucks, because we know as they start to be delivered from OEMs to fleets like Walmart, UPS, PepsiCo have ordered EV Class 8 heavy-duty trucks, and we know that they are going to have to be carrying four or more batteries, which are very heavy, and that battery weight actually eats into the payload and really changes, sort of negatively affects the economics of freight as it is electrified. And so we want to be able to offer the flexibility to fleets to be able to take off some of those batteries from the trucks and use EV charging lanes on the nation's interstate and highway system to power these vehicles dynamically while they're making their way across the country or across the region. Just to let you know, this is not an R&D project. These projects have moved from R&D to project planning and hopefully project construction, particularly in Orlando, Florida, one that we're involved in with Austin, Texas, with the city of Austin, envisioning how inductive charging lanes might be able to provide cleaner power to mini mobility and also to electric vehicle, to EV bus transit. I'm going to move now quickly to the roadsides. You're actually looking at an aerial of a megawatt solar farm located on the roadsides of the RAE Highway in West Georgia at exit 14. If you can see that tanker truck at the very bottom of your screen, those are the northbound lanes of I-85 headed from LaGrange to Atlanta. And just above that tanker truck are the empty lanes going southbound. So you can see the triangle of land that is created at this diamond interchange. There are four triangles at this one diamond, and each of the triangles is about 5 acres of land. When we approached the Georgia DOT and the Southern Company subsidiary Georgia Power about this opportunity way back in 2016, this particular roadside parcel was already cleared of trees. It was very eroded and it was empty and underutilized. What we were able to do in February of the COVID year last year is to help Georgia Power and Georgia DOT commercialize and bring online a megawatt of DC generating capacity on that 4 acres of land using 2,600 high efficiency solar panels. And this is also the first pollinator friendly right-of-way solar in the United States. Here at home on the RAE Highway. We are working with the Federal Highways Administration and with USDOT and many state DOTs to basically copy this project and scale this type of renewable energy generation on the roadsides across the country. Why would we want to do that? First of all, roadside solar development takes pressure off of agricultural and forest lands. Let me tell you, we have identified about 52,000 acres of roadside land that is available and appropriate for solar generation. Those 52,000 acres of land could support more than 20,000 megawatts of solar generation, which would be enough power to power 12 million electric vehicles if we were able to scale to 100%. So how are we going to do this? How are we going to work with states across the country to assess their roadside land and to plan solar and even wind energy generation projects on the roadsides? Well, for the solar piece, the RAE has worked with ESRI, really the world's premier GIS mapping experts, to develop a solar mapping tool. And I want to tell y'all, if you have any connections in your own state or in your own region, we're working with city governments, county governments, state DOTs, turnpike and tollway authorities to assess roadside parcels for solar energy generation. So please let us know if you can connect us to a transportation operator in your area. These are actual shots or screen grabs from Iowa DOT's data sets being analyzed for solar energy generation. And you can see that the tool can assess solar radiation potential using local factors. It can also make an equivalent of that solar radiation potential into potential revenue based on local solar economics, and also a carbon reduction or a vehicle reduction equivalency for the transportation operator. So if I'm a transportation operator, I may actually be more concerned about reducing cars on the road or reducing carbon that is attributed to my transportation system. This tool can do it all. Dollars and cents, vehicles removed, carbon reduced. And we do that based on real local information about solar radiation. We also take into account slope and elevation plus solar radiation to give us a suitability tool. So it's not really just what can we do on the roadsides, but what should we do on the roadsides. And you can see what we should do in those bright green areas that are highlighted on the roadsides of this Iowa DOT data set. We can also, using the LIDAR point cloud, remove tree cover. Now I'm going to tell you, we at the RAE do not support tree clearing, but as you know, state DOTs do engage in tree clearing. And so we can be a part of that conversation. If state DOTs and other transportation operators are removing trees from the roadsides due to safety concerns, we can then step in and imagine productive uses of that newly cleared land. And we also have a digital twin technology built into the ESRI tool that can assess unintended consequences and societal impacts of solar built on the interstate and highway right-of-way. So this screen grab is showing you an interruption to a scenic view shed as a result of a planned solar site on the Iowa roadsides. We were able to actually take away a few of the solar panel rows to restore the view shed, and we were able to give the DOT the comparison of what were the benefits and what were the losses of addressing that view shed impact up front. This is not just an assessment tool for roadside solar, but this is a planning tool, and it's very powerful. We hope it's going to accelerate roadside renewables across the country. And Federal Highways is working with us in this effort. In April of this year, they issued guidance making it absolutely crystal clear to state DOTs that the roadsides of the interstate system are appropriate for EV charging, solar energy generation, high voltage DC transmission lines buried on the roadsides, and also better vegetative management. And I want to end my remarks by just telling you quickly, I have like 2 minutes left, but I'm going to tell you quickly what are some of the low-hanging fruit that we can do on the roadsides. This actually demonstrates the benefits of pollinator-friendly solar. You can see when we grow turf grass on the roadside so that it looks like a golf course or a lawn, we do this a lot in the Southeast, don't ask me to explain it, but you really don't get much ecosystem services and you don't get much protection from soil erosion and from soil degradation when you're just growing turf grass. So we are full bore at the RAE in pushing state DOTs to develop high growing meadows of native perennial grasses and flowering habitat to support pollinators, control stormwater, reduce erosion, and restore our soils. Let me tell you this, over the next 10 years, we want to have a conversation with DOT about their roadside soils. If we can restore the soils on the roadsides, they're better able to sequester and capture carbon right there on the roadsides of the lanes themselves. And this is what I'm going to end with, super quick. low-hanging fruit. Ray Anderson would call this so right, so smart. If you're still driving a gas-powered vehicle and your tires are not properly maintained, you're wasting fuel and you're increasing unnecessarily your emissions from your tailpipe. NOx, SOx, and yes, carbon. So please look at innovations like the Wheelwright tire safety system. This is a UK piece of technology that we have on the Ray. It measures tire tread depth for safety, tire pressure for the environment. It also looks at sidewalls, tire sidewalls for damage. So think school buses, bus transit systems that are picking up passengers from the street side. It also will weigh in motion and it will take tire temperature. And you can see these are real photos from the Ray. We're extremely concerned about tire waste, just like Ray Anderson was concerned about carpet waste. We're incorporating scrap tire rubber into high performing asphalt. If you're interested at all in rubber modified asphalt, we have a webinar coming up with the Tire Manufacturing Association in just a couple weeks. This is a great innovation for asphalt and for road materials as we move deeper and deeper into our climate change reality. And I'm done, Madeline. Here's my contact information. Here's a snapshot of some of the technology partners we work with. I told Madeline I didn't want to sound like a car salesman, like, and there's more, but I did want to try to show you all of the different ways that our work in the transportation sector with technology and innovation has a direct alignment and dovetail with the work of your organization. And I hope that we can support each other more regularly moving forward.
Allie, I'm sure you're not done. This was so fantastic, so hopeful. And folks, before the call started, Allie said to me, I'm in it to win. And don't you just love a person with that attitude? I know there's a lot of questions in the chat that you sparked, but what you had to say is so in the heart of what President Biden and Congress are discussing these days in terms of infrastructure and climate. So I'm going to jump in with the question first of what would you most like to see in that package? Like if you had three wishes and a magic wand, what would you get done through that?
Being with my Ray hat on, number one, clean transmission. I'm going to tell y'all, we can't achieve the White House goals on clean energy. No more dirty energy by 2030. Clean energy, I think by 2050, we can't achieve those goals, nor can we achieve the electrification goals, 500,000 EV charging stations, if we don't deal with transmission. That's the straw in between. Our grid is the straw and it's too small. We can't put on more renewables when we need to, and we actually can't supply the demand, the growing demand in the transportation sector with EV vehicles of all types, passenger, light duty trucks, and oh my gosh, medium and heavy duty. We can't supply those demands with the small straw. And so the Grid Development Authority has already been put forward by the White House and also by Congress. Not really sure what that means. We definitely want a funded agency or a funded authority to deal with transition. And we also need an ITC to support the companies and the agencies that will build new transmission. We think it absolutely should be buried on the roadsides of the interstate. It will be resilient from weather impacts. It will be more resilient from foreign attacks. And we won't have to have aesthetic concerns or health concerns that are related with overhead transmission. So that's number one, and I'll go quickly. Number two, what we would love to see is a change to the US code that dates all the way back to 1960s that prohibits the commercialization of EV charging and truck stop electrification at visitor centers, rest areas, and truck parking. This is the fight of our lives right now, and I very much identify with our lives that y'all are in as well. These are the fights of our lives, and we're not going to be able to supply the needed services to truckers and to travelers on the interstate system if we can't charge for the service of EV charging and truck stop electrification. Truck stop electrification just allows truckers to idle on grid power instead of using their polluting diesel fuel. So that's number two. Number three, some kind of benchmark or mandate for rubber modified asphalt. We had one in 1991 in the Ice-T of the Clinton era. It came at a time when rubber modified asphalt was an early technology, had just been developed in the 1980s. It's now a 40-year-old technology. We have a lot of providers, we have a lot of choices, we have a lot of data about rubber modified asphalt, and it's time for us to return to a benchmark or a mandate for rubber modified asphalt. Why? Because we're generating 300 million waste tires every year, and it takes 100 years for a tire to biodegrade in the landfill. It is a it is one of the most concerning waste issues in transportation, period. I know we think a lot about EV batteries, and we think a lot about solar panel waste at the end of their lives, but I mean, end of life tire upcycling opportunities need to be one of our moonshot focus areas as well.
Cool. Wow. All right, let's get it. Dan, what are you seeing in the chat?
Wow, this is just a fantastic discussion. I love it. A lot of good questions. Ali, I'll ask, we in Idaho, rental car companies won't stock electric vehicles because they say there aren't enough charging stations. So it's kind of a bit of a circular problem. Do you see the work that you're doing is kind of addressing that infrastructure need?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely support the Biden administration's goal around 500,000 charging stations. There's often discussion about how those charging stations are deployed in urban areas. We're particularly concerned that we also focus on interstates and highways, because when you rent a car, right, you want to go from maybe one city to another city on a little bit of a road trip. Maybe you've flown into a new area and you want to get around in that city, but you may also want to participate in activities outside of the city. And so it's really important that we're offering EV charging on the highway and interstate system. And I want to focus for a quick second on what we think is one of the most important things about interstate charging. It cannot be level two. It also cannot be 50 kW or 75 kW. I know I may be talking in technicalities, but this is super important. We have to be able on the highway and interstate system to get people in and out. 15 minutes is what USDOE has established as a benchmark. We need to have 300 miles of range, and we need to be able to get people in and out in 13 to 15 minutes. I am on board with those benchmarks, and I'm telling you that's 150 kW on the interstate and highway system. It's a more expensive charger, but you won't be hanging out at a rest area for 4 hours. So these are trade-offs, but it's really important for success. Success isn't just about getting the policy or funding the initiative. Success is in the execution. And I'm telling you right now, interstate highway charging needs to be a focus. 150 kW is what is the benchmark or the minimum that we should be investing in.
That's great. When it comes to integrating the charging within the lanes themselves, do you see any type of loss of efficiency as opposed to just plug in? And do you, and in the same vein, is there any risk in terms of the temperatures? You know, we've seen some intense high temperatures out west. Can it withstand those extremes?
So I'm going to be real. I don't know how the technology will perform at 130. And that's what's expected today, which would set the world's all time in all history record. So we're in some uncharted territory with climate, our climate experience right now and our weathering. So I can't tell you how the technology will perform at 130. I know that we need to be performing extreme R&D on this technology, extreme testing that will reflect our extreme weather conditions. I do want to talk about the efficiency. I want to remind you, this is the National Science Foundation funded center. So I believe this is true. The efficiencies documented are 87% to 94% over the air while in motion. I know a lot of you are shaking your head and you're going, she's just wrong. I've been to Utah. I've experienced the technology myself at 25 kW. That was back in 2018. They've now moved to 50 kW to 100 kW, and they're still documenting 87% efficiencies of power transfer and higher. You know, we need to embrace technologies like these, if only because of the promise that it holds for electrified freight. We have to get batteries off of Class 8 tractor trailers so that they can include more payload. Otherwise, the economics don't work for the fleet operators. It's just facts on the ground.
fascinating.
Don, I'm going to have to stop you. And I can hardly, I just can't bear to do it. It's, I hate the thought of ending this conversation. And the only way I can bear it, Allie, is because I am absolutely sure we're going to keep talking and that there will be more ways for us to figure out how we help each other and more chances for our volunteers to dive into these details with you that I know they're eager to do. So, thank you from the bottom of
thank
my heart.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you, Dawn.
I know
thank
every you. One of us just wishes you great success. Yeah.
I want to say thank you to Ken Kirby in Georgia, Dave Ains in Georgia, also Herb Brown up in Massachusetts in the Northeast, my very good friends. And Madeline, my new very good friend, thank you so much for the opportunity to have this conversation with you and your organization. I won't beg, but please have me back.
We will find a way, I am convinced. No begging needed. All right.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome to stay on a little longer and listen to the next 10 or 15 minutes if you'd like to catch more CCL news, but I know you have a lot to do and weekends are precious. So
thank you, Madeline.
Thank you. Thank you. Okay, so let's continue the theme just a moment of noticing the allies and fellow travelers we have. I am really pleased to let all of you know that a new climate-focused political action committee has been formed, independently of CCL, but with a mission that may resonate with you. You know that CCL is pretty unique in the climate space for our persistent effort to engage both Republicans and Democrats in working together on climate solutions. It's also quite rare among political action committees. Most PACs give either to Democrats or Republicans, and very few give to both. So people have sometimes commented to me that they think there's a need for a PAC that supports members of Congress of both parties to step out on climate legislation. Well, now there is one. It's called Americans for Action on Climate Fund. CCL did not start it, and it is a completely separate organization that legally must and will operate separately from CCL. But you will see some familiar names on its board of directors: Ian Harrison, Jim Tolbert, Olivia Malonis, and Ben Pendergrass, to be specific. They each felt strongly that a PAC is needed and put their personal time into organizing it. And I'm very grateful for that, to them for doing that. You can see the Americans for Action on Climate Fund website at afaocf.org. Okay, those initials come from the name of the PAC, Americans for Action on Climate Fund, afaocf.org. If you have questions, please take them to the PAC board president, Ian Harrison, and not to CCL staff, because as I said, this PAC is a completely separate organization from us. And you can get Ian's contact info on the website, afaocf.org. Okay, on to the actions. The actions this month help us move out of COVID. We suggest that you return, that you work on your own post-COVID planning. When and how you return to in-person meetings, or when and how will you return to in-person meetings, and are there virtual activities that you want to incorporate? So how fast you move, of course, needs to be tempered by your local conditions and the degree of vaccination in your area. There's a bonus action that's encouraging you to hold an in-person social gathering if it's safe in your area. I have to say, it did me a world of good to meet and hug my fellow chapter members a few weeks ago. Zoom just cannot compete with sitting down at a bar with them, although Zoom was nice this morning too, folks. All right, the second major action focuses on our grassroots lever. It's time to start dusting off your sign-up sheets and display boards and getting yourselves out there and tabling and presenting again, keeping safety in mind still. As an organization, we need to keep growing our grassroots army. And the communications exercise asks everyone to practice inviting friends to CCL, another skill to dust off and put to use, perhaps by inviting a neighbor or a family member to your chapter social event or your next meeting. I also want to draw your attention to a new addition to our grassroots outreach activities. We're adding community service as a grassroots activity that you can record in the action tracker. We've already been suggesting this as part of our outreach to diverse communities, so that rather than come with our CCL agenda to those organizations, that we come and help out with their work And in the course of helping out, we make new friends and build relationships. And that many times has been shown to lead to interest in your climate work once they've gotten to know you. So you can learn more about service and about coming out of COVID on our Thursday webinar this week. Okay, let's return now to a few more updates on our work. Representative John Curtis of Utah recently formed a new conservative climate caucus. So not CCL's conservative caucus, but a conservative climate caucus for members of Congress. And a third of Republicans in the House have joined it, a third. Representative Curtis says, quote, "We've done a wonderful job of telling people what we don't like, and we actually have quite a few good ideas, and we want a seat at the table." So here's how I think you should use this news, especially if you have a Republican member of Congress. I think you should listen to Representative Curtis when he talks about it and read his interviews and study carefully how he says to work with members of his party. Then try to follow his advice. Resist the urge to rush over and ask those Republicans to support carbon pricing or to join the new caucus if they aren't in it yet. Resist that urge before you've had the kind of conversations that he's suggesting. Because Representative Curtis has an important and necessary goal for the Conservative Climate Caucus, which is to help the GOP get more comfortable with talking about climate and climate solutions. That could change everything. They aren't going to support particular legislation as a caucus. So no matter how urgent we feel about that, we have to keep meeting people where they are, and this will be part of bringing them along. You're also doing a fantastic job of gaining new endorsements for the Energy Innovation Act. We now have endorsements from 345 local elected officials, including 78 mayors, 118 city or county council members, and 99 state legislators. Let's keep that going. Three other endorsements this year that caught my eye include one from author Frances Moore LePay, known to many of us older folks as the author of Diet for a Small Planet, an endorsement from Joe Dante, the director of the movie Gremlins, and Avocado Green Mattresses, the world's first mattress brand to be climate neutral certified. So I want to lie on one of those mattresses, eat rice and beans like I did back in the 70s, and watch Gremlins in appreciation. Thank you to the volunteers who made those contacts and to all of you who are doing the patient work of reaching out for endorsements. And we've had some really great media coverage in recent weeks. Our own Vice President of Government Affairs, Danny Richter, was featured on a Climate Now podcast discussing carbon pricing, of all things. And then Fareed Zakaria, Washington Post columnist, and host of CNN's Fareed Zakaria GPS, he used the final 4 minutes of his Sunday show a few weeks back to tell his audience that the best way to fight climate change is with a, you know what, carbon fee and dividend. All right, add that to the 3,313 media hits you've created so far this year. It adds up to a lot of free media. But since this is an extra important time to get our message out, CCL is also actively helping to spread the word on the merits of a price on carbon via a targeted paid digital ad campaign. So we're going to run a short video ad we're currently using that ties in carbon pricing to other top priorities of the Biden administration.
Climate change is one of our greatest challenges, but America turns challenges into opportunities. Carbon pricing is today's great opportunity to make America a worldwide clean energy leader. Putting a price on carbon pollution will combat climate change quickly and effectively and incentivize innovation, transforming our economy and creating millions of new jobs when we need them most. Carbon pricing, our opportunity to do something good for the economy, the environment, and America. Let's get back to work.
As we close out the meeting, I want to give two quick shout outs that came to me this morning from your regional coordinators. First, a shout out to our Springfield, Ohio chapter in the Land Horsemen, who leads their monthly calling campaign. While many groups struggle to get up to a 50% caller rate, Luann's team consistently makes 90 to 100% of their calls. So keep that magic going, Springfield. And second, I love this LTE by Rockford, Maryland volunteer Michael Wilcove in today's Washington Post. The headline is, "He Double Dares Congress." And here's what the LTE says. In a sting, Greenpeace UK duped Exxon executive Keith McCoy into thinking that he was talking to a job recruiter. In that conversation, Mr. McCoy said that Exxon's support for carbon pricing was an easy talking point because, quote, "nobody is going to propose a tax on all Americans," unquote. Whether this accurately portrays the general mindset within Exxon, Congress should prove him wrong. Five bills are pending in Congress that, if passed, will put some type of price on carbon. Carbon pricing has support across the political spectrum. Rather than dwelling on the cynicism expressed by Mr. McCoy, let's get Congress to pass carbon pricing legislation. Besides saving our planet, it's the best, quote, revenge, unquote. That was Michael Wilco, Rockville, Maryland, CCL, in the Washington Post today. Michael, you nailed that in 124 words. So that's it for today, folks. Stay safe and have fun out there while we do what Michael said. Get Congress to pass carbon pricing legislation.
My top recommendation, honestly, would be just to have a carbon tax.
Carbon fee.
A carbon tax.
Carbon pricing.
Carbon tax.
Price on carbon.
When you put a price on carbon, everything else works.
The United States sets out on the road to cut greenhouse gases in half by the end of this decade. This is the decisive decade. This is the decade we must make decisions that will avoid the worst consequences of the climate crisis. Those that do take action and make bold investments in their people in clean energy future will win the good jobs of tomorrow and make their economies more resilient and more competitive.
I'm very, very open to a carbon tax, carbon dividend.
Some kind of a price on carbon.
Simply to put in place a carbon tax.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.